This is a Radio.com original.
And this is KNX In Depth. I'm Mike Simpson.
And I'm Charles Feldman. Well, everybody, how was your weekend? If you're like most people, it's probably been tension-filled with efforts to try to minimize it, right, Mike?
Same as the last few weekends.
Yeah,
right?
It's like it all bleeds into one another. But hopefully you're all still getting by okay, and you're all with us, at least for the next hour or so. And, you know, as we enter the second month of our forced lockdown to stop the spread of coronavirus, there's a complicated tension, and it is clearly emerging, a deep longing for all of us to return to normal, to visit with our friends, our family, return to offices, schools, restaurants, God knows restaurants, versus a continuing fear of being infected and getting sick. And it is that tension, more than President Trump or public officials, that will determine when and how things develop. So we will go in depth on that. That also leads us to this question. If there are stages to a pandemic, what stage are we in?
So we'll try and take a look at that. So while the early cases presented like they were intense pneumonia, a lot of doctors are now rethinking the way that COVID-19 works within the body, and then they're rethinking how to treat it. So were we doing things the wrong way at first? And so far, the food supplies have remained uninterrupted, but that could be changing. The closure of a key meat processing plant in the Midwest could be serving as a major warning sign.
But let's begin with this set of competing emotions, getting back to normal, continuing fear of infection, all of this kind of blended together as one sort of weird soup. Dr. Ali Mokhtad is a chief strategy officer for population health at the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. Before that, he served for years over at the CDC. Thank you for joining us, Doctor. So this is a tough time for all of us, I'm guessing for you as well. On the one hand, most of us are scared to death of getting the virus. On the other hand, we also want to go about our normal lives. How do we do all of this? How do we kind of take these conflicting emotions and make sense of them?
Thank you, and good afternoon. This is where we are right now. So basically, we're seeing progress in many states. The virus circulation is coming down and mortality is coming down. For example, in California, we see it, it will start coming down, and it's coming down. And when you look at the numbers, we have a threshold here at IHME where we set 0.3 per million deaths per day, per state or per country. That means we are at a comfortable level that we can consider going back to normal. Looking at California, it's around May 1st, May 2nd, 12 deaths per day in our projections. But since this is a new virus and we're all susceptible to it, we have to be extra careful. And the only way we can go back to normal is our ability to do tests for the people who are going back to work to make sure that the virus is not circulating anymore in our own community.
Yeah, so that would be the multiple forms of testing, right? You have to test and trace those with symptoms better than we're doing now, although there are more tests now. And then also the antibody tests, right? So you can feel more comfortable knowing if you've had it already that you're probably not going to get it again, and you can be one of the people who goes back to work.
Exactly. So we can test for antibodies. Some people already are protected anyway. We don't know for how long. We have to keep testing for these antibodies. But yes, we have to stage our return to what we call normal. It's not to be normal like our normal before until we have a vaccine, of course. But yeah, we can test a workforce, let some people out, relax some of our measures that are working extremely well for California, for Washington, for all the states that use them, and check if there is a circulation of the virus, early testing, tracing these cases for contact that they came with, doing isolation, and then be careful. And then we could relax a little bit more if we're not introducing the virus.
But what do you say to people who are now going stir crazy?
I would say, you know, what you have done and all the sacrifices we have made as a country and lost some of our friends and loved ones, it's working. And we have to be a little bit more patient. Give us time to have more tests available and to have a blueprint for how we could come back to normal. Remember, if you put at it like example what we have done after 9/11, you know, when flying, we said, no, let's stop all the flying. Then we said, let's go back. We put metal detector. We check you. You go on the plane. Then we changed our way. Everybody complained early on. It takes so long to to check into the airport. Now we're doing it better. We have TSA pre-approved and so on. We have better tests for letting people on a plane. We have to be adaptable of any reality until we have a vaccine.
Plenty of people, though, who would love to go back to normal, but maybe even if they, you know, called it and said, here's the weekend that everything opens back up, they're still not going to leave the house because they're not ready for a restaurant yet. They're certainly not ready for a concert or a baseball game because there's so many people. So what do you think comes back first? You know, you get together with the neighbors instead of people you don't know, or you take a road trip instead of getting on a plane.
That's exactly what I mean. Our normal is not going to be the same anymore. You would see more people wearing masks and gloves from now on in the U.S. until we have a vaccine. Again, if we go back to normal, whatever the new normal is, we need to still practice social distancing, and we need to make sure we don't bring the virus home. That's why we're saying let's do it in stages. Perhaps maybe not opening a small restaurant where people are going to be close to each other, more, you know, less than 6 feet. But if there is a restaurant that has a way to allow people in one way and leaving out one way and have a separate, you know, can the tables be spread apart and so people who are coming are family members, I could take my wife and daughter and go and have a meal at that restaurant. So a new reality, new way of doing business, we can figure it out, but we have in the public health, population health, we have to hear the public. We have told them to stay at home. They've done a wonderful job, and it's paying, and we are saving a lot of lives. We have now our duty is to come up with a solution to say how we come back to normal in a staged way in order to keep the gain that we have and not risk any losses.
Dr. Ali Mokhtad, Chief Strategy Officer, Population Health, University of Washington Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, served for years at the CDC. Doctor, thanks.
Now, you've heard, I'm sure, all of you, about the stages of denial, right? I mean, every time we start the show, Mike and I go through that. Stages of denial.
Every day pulling into the parking garage.
Denial, yeah. Well, you know, there are stages of a pandemic, too. So where exactly are we in that process when we come back? You're listening to KNX In Depth. Along with Mike Simpson, I'm Charles Feldman.
Reminder, next hour on the show, what if doctors and scientists have been approaching this novel coronavirus the wrong way this whole time? We talk with one doctor who has new thinking on treating the virus.
And by the way, the KNX In-Depth podcast, as always, available for free. Just download the radio.com app onto your smartphone. Mike and I also do a daily podcast that is just about the latest developments involving this pandemic, and it's called Coronavirus Daily World on Pause. So you can get that also absolutely free. Right now, though, much like stages of denial, there are stages of a pandemic. Stage one would be containment, but with an illness as contagious as COVID-19, those efforts might have always been doomed to a failure. So where do we stand now? Dr. Gerald Parker directs the Biosecurity and Pandemic Public Policy Program at the Bush School at Texas A&M. Thank you, doctor, for joining us. I read, I think it was an article with you in it, maybe you were authoring it, I forgot now, but it was very interesting, I thought, about where we stand, how we get to the next stage. What stage are we in, and how do we get over this entire thing?
Well, thank you for letting me join you this afternoon. And so we are currently in phase two, and that's mitigation. But first, let me go back and speak a little bit about phase one, containment. And I wouldn't categorize that as always doomed to fail. That's really was part of our strategy back in the President Bush 43 administration as we were planning for H5N1 influenza pandemic. Containment is very early. We want to try to slow the spread to the United States, and that was essentially phase one. And knowing with a respiratory virus like COVID-19 is, and we know much more about it, we know that was going to be almost impossible to do, but you got to take measures to slow the spread so that we can begin to take measures to prepare. And so now we are in mitigation phase two, and we are squarely in the middle of mitigation phase two. And that's why we've across the nation and in your community have implemented community-wide social distancing measures to keep us out of the public and try to slow the transmission of the virus within our community. And so, but we cannot stay in lockdown mode forever. We need to get our economy open back up. We need to resume some type of semblance of normalcy, although I believe we will have a new normal. Cannot predict exactly what that new normal is, but we do need to move on to what is called phase three. And I'm terming that yet another phase of containment and before we have a vaccine.
Yeah, because you kind of have to go back to continue. You mitigate enough. I don't want to cut you off here, but you mitigate to the point where you can try and get back to some sort of containment, and that's through all the testing and tracking of different people. If maybe you're sick in your office, then you know who you've been in contact with at least.
Well, that's it. That's exactly right. You know, I think everybody now is getting familiar with the epi curves, and in the United States, in some places we're getting to the apex or the height of the curve. Some are still on the exponential phase up, but some are getting to plateau. But all of us at some point, sooner than rather than later, I hope, will be on the downslide of the slope. And as we begin to get in a position where we have ever-increasing, you know, new numbers of cases in our community, then we will be in a position where we can implement containment again. But we're going to have to do it in a different way than we did the first time. We're going to need much more aggressive measures of containment. I mean aggressive by we're really going to have to beef up our public health component. And we're going to have to beef up and really greatly expand the laboratory testing capability that we have now, not only testing for the virus, but also testing for the antibodies so we can really better understand what level of infection or virus that we already have in our community.
So I suspect that people will feel and officials will feel a certain amount of relief when there are at least one or more treatment modalities that have been proven, as opposed to just guesswork, but proven to have worked in lieu of a vaccine, which might be a year and a half, maybe even two away from mass distribution. Are there treatments that you think will come along that through double blind, you know, placebo controlled tests will prove to be effective within what time frame?
Well, I'm very optimistic that we will have some antivirals or a monoclonal antibody, you know, in our toolkit. The antivirals probably come sooner than the antibody type monoclonal antibodies that are produced in a lab and scaled up. So I'm very optimistic, in fact, that we will have some antivirals or treatments in our toolkit. And I'm going to put that in the 3 to 6 month category. I'm being that might be a stretch goal, but our scientific engine and industry and academia are working overtime to try to, one, repurpose already approved FDA antivirals that have already, at least in initial studies, looked promising that might be effective for COVID. And then, two, we have scientists and industry in both universities and industry actually designing by molecular basis new antivirals that could impact COVID-19. And we also are working on not only convalescent serum that you probably heard a lot in the last few days, over the last week, but also designing monoclonal antibodies that could be made in the lab. So I'm fairly optimistic that we're going to be able to repurpose some already existing antivirals, but we do have to subject those to the appropriate randomized clinical trials to know whether they, in fact, are effective and will be safe with the doses needed to treat COVID patients.
The eventual end phase, is that the vaccine, and is this a one and done, or everybody gets it and you're okay, or is this like you get a coronavirus vaccine every year like you get a flu shot?
Well, I wouldn't call the next is the end game. Let me talk about, because phase four is what I call containment with a vaccine. And so vaccine, I think, will be at least 18, 24 months. A vaccine is much more difficult, and it will be unprecedented, in fact, if we were able to get a vaccine within 18 to 24 months. But we're making unprecedented progress already in our vaccine development. There are already 3 to 4 vaccine candidates that have just entered phase one clinical trials, but there's a lot more to doing the manufacturing scale up and go from phase one to phase two to phase three, and we absolutely must make sure that a vaccine that's going to be used in the population is going to be safe. So there's a lot of work to do with the vaccine. So it will take some time. But we at this point, most scientific thinking does not believe that we are going to rid the world of this virus, like what happened with SARS back in 2002 and 2003. That virus went away. But this virus is circulating, you know, globally now, and is likely to be with us for a while.
So let me interrupt only because I want to ask, if somebody gets this now, today, so not 18 months from now when there's a vaccine, or even say that 3 to 6 month period when you're hopeful there'll be proven therapeutics. But if someone gets it now and they're unfortunate and have a serious case, what's their hope now?
Well, you know, our physicians, our frontline physicians actually are learning a whole lot more today about how to treat COVID patients symptomatically, and even those that are going into ICU and need vent support. And so we're learning a lot on the front line about, you know, what are the best practices in providing supportive care and the life-saving care. You know, and some physicians are, you know, beginning to prescribe and treat some of their patients off-label with some of these antiviral drugs. But I think the bottom line is the appropriate intensive care that those who are unfortunate fall into the very serious care that requires ICU treatment. But we're trying to keep patients out of that.
Dr. Gerald Parker there, directs of Biosecurity Pandemic Public Policy at the Bush School at Texas A&M. Doctor, thanks.
8 o'clock tonight, a repeat of KNX In Depth coming up. Forget about treating coronavirus patients with ventilators. Some doctors are saying, what about hyperbaric chambers?
You're listening to KNX In Depth, along with Charles Feldman. I'm Mike Simpson.
Well, we all have found out in the past few weeks what we don't have a lot of. We don't have toilet paper, right? Hand sanitizer, all that stuff you can't get, or at least it's really hard to get. Food has not been a big problem yet. But a little bit later in the show, we're going to talk about some problems that are now starting to crop up, and it may have a great impact on the food supply chain.
Right now, though, when the first cases of this virus were reported out of China, they were characterized as a possibly new form of pneumonia, which led to treating the critical patients with ventilators. But we may have been approaching things the wrong way. Dr. Alan Katz is a specialist in hyperbaric and emergency medicine, practicing in Manhattan and Long Island, New York. So, Dr. Katz, what do you make of how we've been treating this virus all along?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I mean, part of what I think we are approaching wrong at this point is treating it as a viral disease, as a standard pneumonia. And most of what we're really starting to see is that it's acting more as a disease where we're unable to oxygenate the body. The lungs itself mechanically are working well, but we're unable to oxygenate. We're seeing patients that are purely hypoxic. So air is being brought into the body, but it's not transferred from the lungs to the blood, and it's not carried properly from the blood around to the rest of the organs.
So that would mean, I would gather, that the treatments that are being tried to a large degree, the antivirals, the anti-inflammatories, may not work as some doctors think they would?
Yeah, yes and no. Anti-inflammatory, possibly. But part of what has to happen is we need to find a better way to get oxygen to the body, to the tissue. So what we're seeing is that the lungs itself are, because of the viral particles attaching to lung tissue, we're starting to secrete and ooze fluid. And this is creating a barrier that's not allowing oxygen to be transferred to the blood. And then on top of that, we're finding that the blood itself, the hemoglobin in the blood, is not attaching properly to oxygen, and it's not allowing oxygen to be carried around the body. In some ways, we're seeing, it appears to be, that the virus itself is really destroying the heme portion of our hemoglobins, which really means that we're releasing iron. Iron is traveling around our body, and it's not appropriately or carrying oxygen. So we can give somebody as much oxygen as we want by ventilation, but we're not getting the oxygen to the body. It's not being passed from the lung into the blood. And once it gets to the blood, it's not being attached to our hemoglobin, so it can't be brought to the body to treat.
So presented with all that, what can you do?
Well, I'll tell you, there are different. We have different thoughts. I mean, part of what I would like to see experimented with and used more in the States is the use of hyperbaric oxygen. I mean, hyperbaric oxygen is really using oxygen under increased pressure. And if we start to do that, we can carry oxygen in the bloodstream. We can get more oxygen dissolved into deep tissue, and we can really bypass hemoglobin.
But as you know, there's a shortage, or at least a lot of places in the country are concerned that there is going to be a shortage with ventilators. I suspect that there are far fewer hyperbaric chambers, or whatever you call the machines, than there are ventilators. So if this is a treatment that ends up being effective, do you have enough equipment to treat people?
Well, again, the hope would be that in using hyperbaric oxygen, we would be able to shut down an inflammatory response, which we know it can do, and we can then take patients and reverse the need for needing ventilation. My hope would be that after as few as two or three treatments, we would have patients that would no longer require ventilation. If we look way back to 1918, there were actual uses of hyperbaric oxygen during the Spanish flu. There was a guy, Dr. Cunningham in Kansas City, actually treated several patients with the Spanish flu using hyperbarics successfully.
Have you seen it tried during this outbreak?
Well, there are case reports out there. Now, we have some case reports out of China where they report on the success in treating several patients, and we have very limited data there. And there are some trials going on right now, clinicaltrials.gov, where there are a few centers around the United States starting to look at it more. But the take-home for me in the world of treating COVID-19 is that it needs to be treated as a pure hypoxia. The danger in this disease is not getting oxygen to the tissue. The mechanical ventilators are not going to be all that useful for us because it's not a problem with the function of ventilation. The lungs are not failing. The lungs are squeezing. The lungs are bringing air into and out of our bodies. The problem is at the interface of the alveoli or the lung sacs and the blood and the blood's ability to carry oxygen. And that's really where we need to focus.
You know, we've asked every expert, I think, probably on this program, the same question. So I'll ask you the same question. Does anybody really know yet how lethal this particular virus is? And by that, I mean the percentage of people who contract it and pretty much go about their lives normally or maybe have a small issue with it, as opposed to those who end up in critical care.
Well, as you know, you probably have 25% of the population that has that is positive for COVID that shows zero symptoms at all. And overall, of the patients that are even symptomatic, it's only about one in five that are even sick enough to need to go to a hospital. But of those patients that are going to the hospital being treated with mechanical ventilations, the mortality is very high. We've not been successful at all in treating patients using mechanical ventilation with COVID.
It's Dr. Alan Katz, specialist in hyperbaric emergency medicine in Manhattan and Long Island, New York. Dr. Katz, thanks.
When we continue, how are the nation's food supplies holding up as we enter our second month of economic lockdown? You're listening to KNX In Depth. Along with Mike Simpson, I'm Charles Feldman.
So even with everybody buying up the toilet paper and the cleaning supplies and the sanitizers, most grocery stores across the country have remained well-stocked on food, especially fresh produce and meats. But a key pork processing plant in South Dakota had to close over the weekend because hundreds of the workers got sick with the virus. And that is a bad sign.
Oh, yeah. Can the nation's food supply chain withstand more people getting sick on farms and processing plants and even among the truckers who haul all of that food to our local markets? Jason Lusk directs the Department of Agricultural Economics or Agriculture Economics at Purdue University. Thank you for joining us. So that's one thing that thus far we haven't worried too much about. You know, as Mike said, we've worried about toilet paper, we've worried about hand sanitizers. Food has been plentiful at all the markets, but is there a real danger that that situation may change soon?
I mean, I think we're still in pretty good shape. You know, even for many food items, I think when the stay-at-home orders first came out, we saw some shelves being stocked out of several items. But pretty quickly, those situations are resolved, and you know, supply chains are recovering from some of that. But I think one of the vulnerabilities that I've had my eye on throughout this whole time have been in meat packing plants, in particular, because the a big percentage of our meat runs through a handful of fairly large processing facilities where there's a lot of workers. And just like the case we just saw that came out here, you have folks that are, you know, could potentially spread, you know, an illness from worker to worker pretty easily. So, you know, I think we're okay. I mean, in the case of pork, we have this pork packing plant that closed down, but at the same time, we have more pork in cold storage right now at the moment than we've had in the last several years. So there's food out there, you know, may just take a little while to get it to where it needs to go.
Okay, so positive is still lots of food. Negative is this is a warning sign, at least going out, that you got to be as safe as possible. Because how much does this one plant provide? You said there's only a handful that actually make up the bulk of what we get.
Yeah, so I think the top 15 pork packing plants produce about 80% of all the pork in this country. So this one plant in particular that went down is about 4% roughly of total supply or capacity in the industry. So, you know, 4% still means there's 96% out there. So that's good news, but it's still, you know, it's not nothing. And even 4%, particularly in those local markets for farmers that were going to supply hogs to that plant, can be pretty disruptive. So I think hopefully if we can keep these things isolated, yeah, it'll cause some local pain, but hopefully the market as a whole will find a way through it.
All right, but now it's pork. There's no reason to believe, is there, that this wouldn't also impact people who work with beef and chicken and anything else?
Well, that's right. I think the, you know, particularly in meat packing, this similar operations, just like you described for different animal species, and similar kinds of market structure in the sense that you know top 10 or so plants in the country probably produce at least half of the nation's commodities, so, you know, or food. So that, I think it's something to keep an eye out on. I know, you know, many of the companies that are involved here, Tyson, JBS, some of those companies, they are being very proactive, you know, taking workers' temperatures before they come in, trying to space out workers in a plant more than they normally do, which is, you know, that means they're running a little slower than they have been, but they're trying to be preemptive. But as we saw with this Smithfield plant in North Dakota, it doesn't always, you know, even the best precautions doesn't always prevent something from happening.
Jason Lusk is with us, directs the Department of Agriculture Economics at Purdue University. Jason, stay with us just a minute away. We're going to broaden this out a little bit here on KNX In Depth. We're back on KNX In Depth. Mike Simpson and Charles Feldman.
And we've been talking about food and the coronavirus pandemic. Jason Lusk at the Department of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University is still with us. So, Jason, there's another interesting development. We were all reading just the other day about how a lot of farmers, for example, because they're losing business from restaurants and other institutional places that want their food, are now kind of tossing it because the market isn't as big as it used to be, and I guess they want to make sure that the prices don't get too depressed by flooding the market with their produce and other food stuff. But a lot of people look at that and they scratch their heads and go, you know, this is a country that for many people there is a food problem with or without the pandemic, and to hear about food just being tossed is kind of sickening in and of itself.
Oh, it is. It's disheartening to see, you know, particularly the dairy pictures we've seen where just have to dump milk out, going to waste, and it is disheartening. You know, I will circle back to our previous conversation about shortages. You know, the good news is, at least as you can see for some of these, is in some cases and for some commodities, we actually have too much at the moment. So there's enough food out there. The real challenge is, can we get it to people? And I think that's what we're seeing in some instances like dairy is, you know, we have supply chains that are set up to deliver to very particular markets that just aren't there anymore. So in the case of dairy, you know, a lot of that milk was going to school children in little, small, tiny cartons, and the plant that's doing that is not, you know, well designed to put it in, you know, gallons or half gallons that we're used to buying in the grocery store. Or it could be a plant that's, you know, producing 50-pound boxes of cheese or sour cream that are going to institutional restaurant establishments. And, you know, again, they don't may not necessarily have the equipment to turn around and put that into a gallon jug that you and I normally have at the grocery store. So I think this is an example where there's a, you know, just a mismatch between how much milk is being produced given the number of cows we have out there at the moment and then the ability to push it through the system in the form that we as consumers can take it and use it.
Do you think some of this can be shifted or with so many restaurants closed, not placing their usual orders or, you know, they're not using as much with takeout that you're just kind of stuck? Because if they're not ordering what they order every week and you're a restaurant supplier, you're not a grocery store supplier, what are you going to do?
Yeah, no, it's a real challenge. That's why, you know, in some cases they're actually dumping the stuff. It's you know, unfortunately, you know, milk is perishable, and it's unless you have a way to convert it into a non-perishable item, you know, something like a, you know, evaporated or powdered milk, you know, it's just tough to do much with it when you don't have any place to store it. But you know, the longer this sticks around, the more, you know, incentive and opportunity there'll be for some of those plants that are configured for one market to reconfigure and to find avenues and opportunities. You know, one thing that'll probably happen too, to be honest, if this goes on for another week or two, is, you know, farmers will probably, you know, make a decision. They don't need that many cows sitting around out there. We'll have more, you know, more burgers. But the, you know, the market will respond. It'll adjust. It's just not, you know, it doesn't happen instantaneously.
So obviously there's an enormous amount of pressure on those who work in the business of producing this nation's food to try to stay well and continue to produce this food, which of course raises the question whether or not those workers are being given adequate protection. Is there any evidence to suggest one way or the other if they are?
Yeah, as I said, I think a lot of food processors are spending a lot of time in thinking about precautionary plans to try to prevent outbreaks from happening in their plant. They have backup plans. I've heard from some fruit and vegetable processors that they're working together with their industry association so that if they go down, maybe they can use the night shift over at a, you know, what would normally be a competitor's plant to try to, you know, help deal with some of these issues. But, you know, some of these things are rated, you know, that I think there'll be increasing discussions about in the weeks and months that come are, you know, you don't want workers showing up if they're not feeling ill because they feel like they're, you know, they have to show up to get paid. And I know there's a lot of discussion about, you know, pay for sick work and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I don't know how that will all shake out, but I think there'll be more emphasis on those kind of conversations in the future.
Jason Lusk, Department of Agricultural Economics, Purdue University. This has been KNX In Depth. Back tomorrow, 1:30.